Welcome to Brew Crime, a true crime and beer podcast.
This is a podcast where we pick a theme, cover a few cases, and pair them with craft beer.
Join me, Mike.
And me, JT.
As we explore the world of crime, conspiracies, or whatever catches our attention. You can find us on social media at Brew Crime or our website, brewcrime.com. And you can find us on any podcast app at Brew Crime Podcast.
Join us as we discuss the horrible crimes that surround us and maybe, definitely tip a bottle or two back as you do it. Drink with us the second and last Tuesday of every month.
Hello, everyone. As always, I'm your host, Paige, and this is Reverie True Crime. I'm still working on the final episode of the Eileen Warnow series, so instead of not giving you an episode on schedule, I pulled this mysterious episode out of the vault. I put together this episode for Mike Morford's podcast, Beyond Bizarre True Crime. You should definitely check it out if you have not. Every week, a different true crime host tells a bizarre true crime story. This is the one I chose to dive into. I think you'll be intrigued, and I'd love to know your thoughts about this unsolved mystery. This is the mysterious case of the Circleville, Ohio letters. In the 1970s, receiving letters in the mail was an everyday occurrence. Snail mail from family and friends was as common as emails and social media DMs are today. Although, for Circleville, Ohio residents, checking the mailbox became an unnerving task in 1976 when they began receiving ominous letters. Think about how violating it must feel for an anonymous person to send letters to your home, the place you feel the safest, threatening you, and exposing your deepest, darkest secrets to everyone around you. Many people of Circleville were receiving letters, but one alleged love affair became the main spectacle. Circleville, Ohio's population is still fairly small, housing around 14,000 people. Back in the summer of 1976, with the population being even smaller, you can imagine the chitter-chatter of gossip, such as what Bill and Betty down the street were going through financially, and what Jane and Jim Bob did over the weekend. The typical everybody knows everybody and their business type of small town, but things are usually whispered about in the living room, not going out of one's way to embarrass the other person. Certainly not mailing out letters to the residents of your town to openly shame your neighbor. One or multiple people began writing and mailing out letters to everyone in Circleville, revealing some of the residents' juiciest secrets. Beyond putting everyone's closeted skeletons out on display, the letters were also sinister, sexual, and filled with threats that struck fear into the ones who received them. Everyone was being watched. The mystery author was sending these handwritten letters from 25 miles away, up north in Columbus, Ohio, with no return address, only the postmark. Gordon Massey seemed to have this picture-perfect cookie-cutter life. He was a married man with a teenage son, and he was doing very well at his job as a school superintendent. On March 3, 1977, Gordon made the usual drive to Westville High School. He thought that day would be like any other. He retrieved his mail, and when he opened one of the envelopes, inside was a piece of paper with writing that was all uppercase, and the text was blockish. Gordon was stunned, to say the least, when he read the contents of the letter, which unveiled he may not have been the perfect husband he portrayed himself to be, after all. "Dear sir, according to my girlfriend, you have asked her to go out many times, and you've asked the other female bus drivers, too. This must stop at once for the good of the school and families. If they're not stopped, I will be forced to write the school board, and I would hate to do that. I suggest you find yourself a pimple-faced whore and start up with her, and leave my girls alone. The writer accused Gordon of not being faithful to his wife, and that he possibly used his status at the school to sleep around with the women who were employed there, particularly bus drivers. The mysterious and menacing mail kept coming. The author was harassing Gordon, telling him they would cut his brakes and slash his tires if he didn't stop sleeping with these women while his wife thought he was a faithful husband. Gordon refused to take these messages seriously. The author sent a 4-page letter to the school board, alleging that Gordon was sexually harassing co-workers and, quote, picks on the weaker ones constantly. The unknown sender told the board to fire Gordon and finished the letter with a warning. I sure hope he does not upset my girl for his sake. On the same day, another letter appeared at Westville High School. The sender claimed to be on the prowl daily, keeping track of Gordon, and included the names of the bus drivers the author claimed to see Gordon seducing. The allegations were simply that, allegations, and Gordon was able to keep his job. The letter writer came up with a new plan, and on March 18th, a letter came in the mail to Westville High School's vice principal. The sender warned that they would be sending proof that Gordon was having an affair with one of the bus drivers, that bus driver being Mary Gillespie. "I want to protect your school. It has a good reputation. You should keep it like that. I shall send you proof about driver number 62917. She has a child in school there now. I shall prove this shortly. I expect him to then be discharged. You'll see that I am telling the truth." Mary Gillespie had already been a target of the secret sender before that letter came to the vice principal. The writer was sending messages to Mary's home that were intimidating, saying they knew all about her affair with Gordon Massey and had been keeping eyes on not only her, but her family too. "Stay away from Massey. Do not lie when questioned about knowing him. I know where you live. I have been observing your house, and I know you have children. This is no joke. Please take it serious. Everyone concerned has been notified, and everything will be over soon." One letter even said, "It's your daughter's turn to pay for what you've done. I shall come out there and put a bullet in that little girl's head." Mary chose not to say anything about these ominous letters. Ultimately, since she claimed she was not having an affair at that time, she paid the writings no mind, hoping no response would make it stop. Quite the opposite happened. Every time Mary went to the mailbox, there was another letter. They began to mound up, and the contents of the messages were becoming more malevolent as time went on. "I know everything. Call the sheriff. He can't watch you forever. RT3, Circleville, Ohio, 62917. Bus number 474-7301. I shall keep ringing. Again, this is no joke either." Mary still told no one about the letters. She held strong to her theory that ignoring the strange troublemaker would eventually make them go away. The month of March came and went, with the letters still accumulating in heaps. April was now beginning, and Mary's husband, Ron Gillespie, received his first letter from the seemingly outraged author. They were sick and tired of warning Mary over and over. It was time to tell Ron the chronicles of Mary's deeds. "Mr. Gillespie, your wife is seeing Gordon Massey. You should catch them together and kill them both. He doesn't deserve to live. By the way, you're a cuckold. P.S. I'm going to murder you for it." Of course, Ron confronted Mary, but she said there was no truth to the letter at all. She decided that moment was the perfect opportunity for her to come clean about the letters she had been sent over the last few weeks. Mary and her husband believed this could be a twisted prank, or the writer got off on this fictitious scenario they had crafted in their mind. The couple had made the collective decision to keep ignoring these warnings, hoping it would just come to an end. Days later, on the 14th of April, there was a letter awaiting Ron in his mailbox. "Gillespie, you have had 2 weeks and done nothing. You are a pig defender. You are also a pig. Make her admit the truth and inform the school board. If not, I will broadcast it on CBs, posters, signs, and billboards until the truth comes out. Only pigs ride motorcycles. Good hunting in your red and white truck on your way to work. I followed him for weeks since last summer and have seen her meet him several times. You will see, this is no joke." Unlike any other letter, this one had an address scripted on it. 550 Ridgewood, Circleville, Ohio. Of course, it was not the address of the author. It was the address of the accused adulterer, Superintendent Gordon Massey. The letters kept haunting and harassing Circleville residents, and there was no indicator as to who was composing these wicked messages. Another letter to Mary stated, "Lady, this is your last chance to report him. I know you are a pig and will prove it, and I'll shame you out of Ohio. A pig sneaks around and meets other women's husbands behind their backs, causes families and homes and marriages to suffer." For a long time, Mary strongly denied that she was seeing Gordon Massey. The sheriff even told news outlets Mary's narrative over and over again. In a turn of events, she eventually confessed that she was having an affair with Gordon. What is baffling to many people is that Mary said the affair began after she received the letters. If that's true, it leaves many to wonder why someone would make such a strange choice. Her life and her family's lives were being threatened. Why would she and Gordon begin this adulterous relationship after being bombarded with these hostile letters? Let's stick a pin in that. I'll get into a few theories later in the episode. Ron and Mary went over the letters with Ron's sister, Karen, and her husband, Paul Freshour. They all sat down and discussed who they thought the sender could possibly be. The name David Longberry came up. He was a bus driver and friend of Mary's who made advances towards her a year prior. Since Mary turned him down, things were a little awkward between the two. Maybe David was disgruntled about the situation, jealous that Mary chose to form a relationship with Gordon instead. The four of them were sure David was guilty of being the writer. They hatched a plan in an attempt to intimidate him so he would stop. Letters began to show up in David Longberry's mailbox, warning him that if he didn't stop his shenanigans and harassment, the police would be notified. Paul said they only sent 4 or 5 letters, and there were no violent threats made at all. Weeks went by, and the Gillespies didn't receive any strange letters. They thought it was over. They thought they could get on with their lives. Ron was driving home from work, as he always did, but this time was different. He saw something on the side of the road that made the hairs on the back of his neck stand on end. It was a sign that accused Gordon Massey of doing something atrocious. The writing on the sign alleged that Gordon was raping Mary and Ron's 12-year-old little girl, Tracy. Ron hopped out of his truck immediately, forcefully extracting the sign from the ground, though it did not stop with this one single sign. Multiple signs were appearing throughout Circleville, mainly on the roads of Mary's bus routes. The whispers about this vile rumor became deafening. Ron's brother-in-law, Paul, said, quote, "Ron was devastated and distraught. He didn't get much sleep during that period in his life. He was frantic and would drive around an hour or two in the morning before his shift began, looking for any obscene posted signs. Ron worked really hard to figure out what it was really all about and to have the problem solved." End quote. All summer long, Ron was busy yanking up these nasty signs until he finally had enough. Needing to remove herself from Circleville for a while, Mary and her sister-in-law made their way to Florida for a much-needed vacation. Ron and 12-year-old Tracy held down the fort while Mary was away. On August 19th, the Gillespies' phone began to ring, and Ron answered. This phone call clearly was riling him up, and it made him really upset. Tracy heard her father yelling at the person on the other end of the line. Whatever the caller said made Ron irate enough to give Tracy a farewell kiss, pick up his H&R 22 caliber revolver around 10 o'clock that night, and storm out of the house, supposedly to find the writer of the threatening letters. Slamming the door of his 1971 Ford truck, he took off into the night, determined. Only 15 minutes later, things took an even darker turn when someone saw a truck was embedded into a tree. Looking closer, the unbelted driver had been hurled midway through the windshield. The driver's side cabin roof was twisted inwards, and the left side door was almost completely gone. It was Ron Gillespie. It was concluded that Ron did not try to end his life on purpose, although maybe someone else was. Police did find that Ron's gun had been fired, maybe by Ron and maybe by someone else, but there was not a bullet hole or bullet casing in sight. We will never know for sure where Ron was going or who fired the gun, but there are many speculations. Another mystery seems to be Ron's blood alcohol level. He wasn't a big drinker at all, but his blood alcohol level came back as 0.16. He was in no shape to be driving. His family insists that foul play was involved in every aspect, but a lot of people do think otherwise. I'll discuss the theories that have been floating around for decades about what could have happened. The police even questioned a person of interest, but they passed a polygraph test and were let go. Ron's wreck was determined to be a drunk driving accident. Ron's death was not going to halt the Circleville letter writer. Mary had letters in her mailbox day after day filled with hate and threats of harm. Other residents were receiving letters as well, accusing Sheriff Radcliffe of covering up how Ron really died. Years went by, and in December of 1982, Mary received a note that warned her things were going to start up again, and in February of 1983, the sender made good on his promise. February 7th, Mary saw a sign on the side of the road as she was running her usual bus route. Again, the sign was accusing Gordon of sexually abusing 12-year-old Tracy. Mary rushed off the bus, jerked the sign out of the ground, and saw a peculiar box placed behind it, attached on top of a pole. There was a string connecting the box and the sign. The strange box was glued shut. Mary hurried home and cracked it open. She discovered a handgun held up with styrofoam. The string attached to the box was connected to the gun's trigger. The wooden post that the box was on was chest or head height. The gun was supposed to go off when Mary pulled on the sign. She swiftly took the firearm to the police, who checked the serial number. Someone tried to file the numbers away, but they didn't do a good job. Police were able to trace it to the gun owner, Paul Freshour. At that point, Ron and Mary's own brother-in-law seem like he might be the biggest suspect in this wicked series of events. Mary spoke to the police about how she and Ron were not awfully close to Paul. They were friendly, but not tight-knit. At the time, Paul was working in Columbus, where the letters were being mailed from. He certainly could have sent the letters easily. It was confusing as to what his motive could possibly be. Why would he want to kill the Gillespie family? Why would he be concerned about an affair if he wasn't even close to Ron and Mary? Was his past traumatic enough to turn him into a callous killer? In 1968, Paul was a prison guard at the Ohio State Pen. A riot broke out, and inmates held him hostage along with a few other guards for 30 hours. Those hours seemed like an eternity. The inmates were making threats to cut the guards' heads off and burn them alive. This impacted Paul's mental health for years after, but he was never violent towards anyone. Paul was questioned by the police. He didn't deny that the gun was his, saying it had been stolen a long time ago. Paul said that he didn't worry about it, chalking it up as a loss. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, the day the booby trap was set, likely the same day it was found, Paul had in fact taken the day off work. However, he did have an alibi for the majority of the day. Still curious, the police asked Paul to do a little writing for them. On February 25th, Paul complied, although the way the police set it up was odd. You'd think they'd ask Paul to simply write things and compare it to the letters. How it actually unfolded was, the police let Paul look at the letters and instructed him to copy the block letters as closely as he could to compare. That doesn't seem like usual or smart protocol. Paul copied the letters, making them look almost the exact same, as he was told. This was used against Paul to take him into custody and charge him with attempted murder with a bond set at $50,000. Circleville was very vocal about how wrong they felt it was for the police to ask Paul to perform the writing test in that manner. Their loud disapproval fell on deaf ears. Paul said, quote, "He would give me an actual letter and ask me maybe to do the envelope part just as near as I could to the envelope. And then, on some, he would take the actual letter out and have me do them as near as I could on the letters. And I did them because I knew I wasn't responsible for the letters." End quote. Paul went to the Southwest Mental Health Facility and planned to plead not guilty at his trial by reason of insanity. For whatever reason, he changed his mind and only pleaded not guilty. During the trial, various handwriting experts took the stand. They allegedly testified that 494 of the letters matched Paul's handwriting from written documents they collected from his job. Only 39 of those letters were evidence in court. Paul did not take the stand to defend himself, even after the jury sat there and heard all of the circumstantial evidence that made him look extremely guilty. His defense attorneys did not do him any favors either, which led Paul to being declared guilty by the jury, and he got slapped with a 25-year maximum sentence. Since Paul, the alleged author and sender of the Circleville letters, was now locked away, naturally, everyone thought they could go to their mailboxes with no worries of hostile letters being stashed inside. They were wrong. There were more letters than ever before being sent all over southern Ohio, still postmarked from Columbus in the mid to late 80s from the secret sender. Paul was behind bars in Lima, Ohio. Even so, authorities prohibited Paul from sending out mail in hopes that would solve the problem. As you have probably guessed, it did not. Mail was not only being sent to people's houses, but to schools, newspapers, and other shops and businesses. Some of the envelopes contained arsenic. Was this a copycat attempting to strike fear into everyone? Did Paul get someone to send the letters? Was the writer someone else entirely? The warden at the prison stated it was absolutely impossible for Paul to be the writer of these letters. There was no way he could have. He was in solitary confinement, still banned from sending mail. The letters were now aimed toward city officials, teachers, but mostly began focusing on Prosecutor Roger Klein. Not just any prosecutor, but the same one who succeeded in putting Paul away. The writer claimed that Roger was sleeping with a teacher, and as a result, she was soon with child. The sender alleged Roger had her killed and helped cover up the crime. The person even said they would take it farther, warning that they would provide the proof by exhuming the bones of the baby. When looking into those allegations, something else abysmal was revealed by the author of the letters. Investigating the accusations of the writer, authorities did find Pickaway County's coroner, Ray Carroll, guilty for sexual child abuse. In December of 1993, he was charged with 12 counts. Some of the charges were for gross immorality, sex crimes, corruption of a minor, pornography, obscenity, and indecent exposure. Paul found out that his wife Karen was having an affair, and eventually they divorced. Their children were put fully in Paul's custody. Karen had to move out of their house, and Mary let her move into a trailer in their backyard. In 1990, it was Paul's chance to be paroled, but his case was thrown out since the mail was still circulating and the town was still being terrorized. The authorities still blamed it all on Paul, even though the guards even said he wasn't sending mail. Shortly after, Paul was on the receiving end of snide letters, heckling him for not being a free man. Now, when are you going to believe you are not getting out of there? I told you 2 years ago, when we set them up, they stay set up. Do you listen at all? No one wants you out. No one. The joke is on you. Ha ha. Tell no one of this letter. I saw the paper. Great news. Great. The sheriff loved it. Ha ha. Do you believe it now? Do ya? Later, journalist Michael Yant found something especially important that was left out of Paul's trial as he looked over the sheriff's investigative file. Quote, Mary Gillespie told the sheriff one of the other bus drivers told her that she had been driving that same road about 20 minutes before Mary Gillespie found that booby trap at exactly that site. And when she went by that very same intersection, there was a yellow El Camino parked there. A large man with sandy hair was standing there. When he saw her come, he turned around and acted like he was going to the bathroom or something, but seemed also to be avoiding any kind of identification. The description of the individual does not fit Paul Freshour at all, and Paul had a very solid alibi for this time. There was no attempt at all to follow up on that lead, and if they had, they would have found that another possible suspect in this case had a brother who had a yellow El Camino. End quote. When Paul was finally out on parole 4 years later, after he spent 10 years in prison, he begged the FBI to take a closer look at the case so he could earn his good name back. He wanted them to investigate Roger Klein, who was at that time a judge, and the accusations of murder against him. To this day, no one has been able to prove a murder ever happened. A teacher's family claims the pregnancy part of the story was true. While Paul was in prison, he typed out every occurrence that took place, which totaled over 160 pages. The person he thought was guilty of harassing Circleville? Sheriff Dwight Radcliffe. When Ron Gillespie died, the sheriff was preparing to become president of the National Sheriff's Association. Paul said it would have been in his favor to keep the Circleville letter writer quiet to help his chances. The FBI didn't take Paul too seriously, refusing to help him. Paul began blogging online and shouted from the rooftops to anyone who would listen about his proclaimed innocence. There is a link in this episode description to Paul's blog if you would like to explore all of his claims. Around the time Paul was released from prison, the letters became less frequent until they stopped altogether. Around this time is also when Unsolved Mysteries and journalist Michael Yant, who had been studying the case for 30 years, got involved. A letter was sent to Unsolved Mysteries, telling them they better rethink their decision about going to Circleville or doing an episode about the events. After the show aired, the writer never sent another letter, and the people of Circleville could finally check their mailboxes without being apprehensive. The Circleville writer is still an enigma to this day, but there are many theories and suspects that have been debated for many years. After this segment, I'll talk about the newest development in the case. First, we have Paul's ex-wife, Karen Freshour. Paul, who passed away in 2012, went to his grave proclaiming his innocence and believed his ex-wife, Ron's sister Karen, set him up. After they separated, she expressed to Mary that she believed Paul was the Circleville writer. She alleged she had found letters stashed around their house, some being ripped up and one in the toilet. She swore that one of the letters had the name Gillespie scrawled on it. She never kept any of them, if they even existed, to back up her story. During Paul's trial, his lawyer's closing argument was, quote, "Who hated Paul enough to try to get him into trouble? If you read the divorce decree, who stands to profit financially if Paul is convicted and goes to prison?" End quote. That person was Karen. Karen's boyfriend at the time strikingly resembled the description of the man beside the yellow El Camino. Karen's brother was said to have owned a yellow El Camino, too. Could Karen's brother be the original Circleville writer? And could he have possibly roped Karen's boyfriend into the situation? Did Karen's brother want to expose Mary? Why was the witness statement about the El Camino left out of trial? Next, we have Mark Freshour, Paul and Karen's son. Paul believes his son Mark stole his gun from him, but he never said anything about it because he would never want to see his son behind bars. Pam Stanton, a close family friend, has always defended Paul, a man who was like a second father to her. She also defended his son Mark. She said Mark was deeply impacted by his parents' divorce and the letters. So much so, it wrecked him mentally beyond repair. Ultimately, Mark completed suicide by shooting himself. His body was found drifting along the Seata River on September 11, 2002. Karen said he had been suffering with depression for years. Was he possibly guilty of writing the letters? Was he involved in setting the booby trap with the gun that Paul says he stole from him? Was Mark trying to get at his Aunt Mary, calling himself protecting and standing up for his father? Could it also be possible that Karen and Mark were the ones behind everything? There are theories about Ron's wreck. The night Ron was killed, many suspect that maybe he drank a lot that night, even though everyone said he was never a big drinker. Mary was out of town, he was at home not planning to go anywhere, and he could have been stressed over the affair and the letters. Maybe he shot the gun out of the window of his truck on accident, or at someone, which is why the authorities never found a bullet casing or bullet hole in the truck. Maybe somebody was trying to run him off the road, so he shot his gun out of the window at them. The author of the letters claimed that Mary and Gordon were to blame for Ron's death, and the sheriff was covering it up by saying Ron's BAC was high when it actually wasn't. Another theory points to the sheriff and possibly other police officers. It was said that cops were trained to write in all capital letters that were square. This was to make their handwriting easier to read. Could this have been the work of a corrupted police department or someone who used to be on the police force? The letter writer blamed the sheriff for covering up Ron's death, but never claimed the sheriff was the author of the letters. Next we have David Longberry, the bus driver who made passes at Mary a year before the letter started. Was he jealous over Mary and Gordon having a fling? Were the family's suspicions right all along? David Longberry completed suicide after going on the run in 1999 for raping an 11-year-old little girl. One of the letters claimed that David Longberry would have been in prison instead of Paul, but Paul messed that up by writing the letters to David, pretending to know he was the writer. They boasted in the letter, "See what that got Paul?" going on to say that Paul would never get out of prison or Sheriff Ratcliffe would take his place. The letter also talks about foul play in Ron's wreck. It also says two teenage boys saw what happened. Quote, "Teenage boys saw what happened. You will always use high speed for elimination of someone if you must get rid of them. You don't fire shots for drinking." A lot of people think William Massey, Gordon's son, is another good suspect. A few of the first mystery letters were signed with the letter W, leading numerous people to think maybe Gordon's son blamed Mary for the affair and wanted her away from his dad. The last suspicious person would be none other than Mary Gillespie herself. How did Mary know to stop at the one sign that was set up as a trap out of the various other signs that lined the road up and down? Plus, with the gun not going off, it made things look even more fishy. Mere coincidence, perhaps? It's rumored that she may have had Ron killed. Some believe she started the letters as a way of getting Ron to leave her so she wouldn't have to confess about the affair herself or even attempt to work out the marriage. However, as much as it may seem she was involved, would she have written those nasty signs about her 12-year-old daughter? There's also a possibility that a lot of these letters were from multiple copycats that had nothing to do with the letters involved in Mary's case. There may have been pranksters. There might have been people taking this as an opportunity to air out others' dirty laundry. There has been new information about the case. One of the FBI's former star profilers agreed to examine these letters for the show 48 Hours. Mary Ellen O'Toole has dug deep into some of the grimmest criminal minds, from the Green River Killer to the Unabomber. Mary Ellen believes without a doubt there was only one single author of 98 letters she examined, and it makes sense. If only one person knows the secret, that person being the writer, they will die with that secret. If even one other person knew, or if there were multiple writers, as was suspected, the secret would have probably gotten out by now. Mary Ellen said there is manipulation all throughout the letters. The first letter from 1977 indicated being the boyfriend of a woman, wanting to make you believe they are a male and not a female. Mary Ellen believed maybe this could be a woman and someone that isn't significantly intelligent due to how the sentences were written. That could have been part of the author's idea, to make spelling errors, but the handwriting expert believes it wasn't purposeful. Which is important because the accused Paul Freshour was a manager at Anheuser-Busch and had a master's degree. There are various other clues that Mary discovered. She said the authors seemed to be having fun, knowing they were hurting others, and they were happy about it. A very insensitive person who knew the difference between right and wrong. The person wanted to do wrong. At this stage, Mary was doubtful it was Paul Freshour. Even though she could not rule him out completely, there were other factors that pointed her towards someone else. She also believes, when it came to the booby trap, that the author of these letters would not have taken the chance to be seen in public, suggesting someone else took advantage of this whole situation. If it wasn't Paul Freshour, that goes against all of the handwriting experts at the trial who said the handwriting matched with things Paul had written at his job. 48 Hours called on Beverly East, a forensic document expert, for her own evaluation. Beverly said she did not want to know what the story was or anything about any of the people involved, because none of it mattered when it boiled down to the evidence. By the writing alone, she says she is 100% sure she knows who wrote these letters. Beverly thoroughly examined letters that Paul wrote to a friend. One thing unusual, his G's are written in a way that were almost like the number 6. She analyzed 49 of the letters, ranging from 1977 to the 1990s. That peculiar-looking G came up a lot in the letters, and in Paul's own handwriting. Not only that, but a zip code he wrote on an envelope matched 3s and 2s of zip codes on the malicious letters envelopes. He writes them with a strange curlicue on the bottom. I'll have these pictures on my Twitter and Instagram for you to take a look at as well. Beverly says numbers don't lie. She stated not all of the letters are in the exact same handwriting patterns, but almost 100 particular quirks of Paul's were able to be identified in the malicious letters, and she believes 100% and would swear on a Bible from the evidence she discovered that Paul Freshour was the man behind the letters. Pam Stanton, the close friend of the family, says nothing anyone says will ever change her mind about the Paul Freshour she knew. When it was brought up that the handwriting experts and forensic analysts of documents had been wrong in the past, Beverly stated, quote, "I cannot speak for others. There are always going to be times where people are inaccurate. And it's not because the science is not accurate. It's because that particular examiner has not done due diligence to arrive at the opinion they should have. You can't be wrong. Because somebody's life and livelihood is at the end of your opinion, so I am not wrong." End quote. Marie Mayhew also found something compelling. No matter what you believe with the writing, this next part is undeniable. Marie went through thousands of pages of the case file. While Paul was in prison, there were dozens of letters sent, as we know. Found on the letters, it has been confirmed, were Paul's fingerprints. It could be a possibility that Paul wrote and sealed many letters before he stepped foot in prison, and someone else sent the letters out. Could his son Mark have helped him? Who would he have trusted enough to send them? Did he have part in Ron's death or the booby trap sign? There is still a lot of mystery surrounding the case of the Circleville letter writer, and a lot of people still don't believe Paul Freshour had anything to do with it. Paul passed away on June 28, 2012. At 70 years old, he was still telling anyone who would listen that he was a wrongly accused man. Quote, "When I'm dead and in my grave, people are going to believe I'm sending those letters." End quote. So, what do you think? Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, y'all stay safe out there and take care.